Welcome back again to another episode of the Live Your Dreams podcast. My name is Joe Gowalis, and again, I'm here with my amazing co-host,
Chris Victor.
This is a very, very exciting episode. We have an incredible guest on today. I think the only real word to describe this person is Renaissance woman. She is incredible. She is an actress, a writer, a director. She has been a star in the independent film world and has been in some massive TV shows, including Law and Order, and has an iconic role in the movie Kick-Ass, starring Nicolas Cage, Chloe Moretz, as she is just an incredible individual, someone that is truly, I'm just proud to be her friend, Miss Deborah Twiss.
Hey, guys.
How you doing? Oh, thank you for coming on. It's really always a pleasure to see you.
Oh, it's so great to see you. I mean, we haven't seen each other in so long, and you guys both look really good, like healthy and happy and
positive, and I love it.
Surround yourself with good people, and you look good, right? Now, do what you love. We're all doing what we love.
Yes, this is very true.
And talking about doing what you love, I mean, you have been in the industry. You're very well respected in the business. You've been in for
really? No, I mean it.
I mean, quite some time. I mean, you started in the 90s, really, right? I think it was your first film, Gun for Jennifer, right? Really kind of broke you in. I'd love to hear, because you've done some amazing independent films, and then again, you've been in some massive Hollywood movies, major TV shows. What inspired Deborah to kind of break into this business at the beginning and start living your dream?
I was 3 years old, and I was standing in front of the TV, and I turned to my parents, and I said, when I grow up, I'm going to live inside there with them.
That's fantastic.
Right? And my parents laughed, and they said, you can only do that if you're an actress. And I was like, oh.
Awesome. And there it is.
And then the first time I had an issue with the script, I was six. I was in first grade, and we had to make these puppets for a puppet show, and I had a very evil first grade teacher, and she wrote a script, and she wanted me, my puppet, to say certain things. And, you know, I had my mom help me read it, and I realized it was stupid, and I said, my puppet wouldn't say that, and I had my mom help me rewrite it. And I brought it, and then that was the end. The teacher really hated me.
That is not
first grader rewriting her words. And then in third grade, I was in an art class, and our teacher came in and said, you know, we're going to have the spring ensemble performance, and if anybody would like to write a little skit or something, you know, 10 pages, 10 minutes, something like that, you know, we'll take a look at it, and maybe, you know. I thought, oh, this is great. I had this great concept for a time travel play. And so I had my dad teach me how to use his electric typewriter and teach me how to do a script format and everything.
That's great.
And I wrote an entire full, you know, play that was an hour long.
Oh, wow.
It was 60 pages. And I brought it in, and I showed it to them, and they loved it. And they said, you know, well, we would love to, like, have this be the centerpiece of the Spring Ensemble performance. Do you have any, you know, can we just, like, get the permission to use it? And this is how it all began. I said, well, you're more than welcome to use it, but I have to star in it.
That's great. That's the right.
And I was in third grade. And, yeah, and then it just continued from there.
So literally, it's almost in your blood, your aura, everything about you is that craft of performing.
Yeah. I remember even, like, I remember the A lot of people don't remember this. For some reason, I remember these things. Like, I remember being born. I remember, like, the way the room looked that I was born in. And I figured at this point, I think the reason I remembered it was so that someday I could go back and make a movie about that.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And I remember even being, like, you know, a baby in a bassinet and crying because, and I was crying because, like, I had, you know, short little arms and legs, and I wanted to turn around and do everything. And every time I would try to speak, and I understood English completely, but I would try to say something, and it would just come out. And, like, I would lay there crying, and I was crying so hard because I was so frustrated. And my parents would come, and they'd be thinking I was hungry or I'd wet my diaper or whatever. And I just would scream, and I'd say, no, I can't run. I can't move, and nobody understands me. And then finally, I just accepted. I just thought, okay, you just need to just relax into it and grow up, and, like, everything's going to grow. Everything's going to be okay. But, yeah, I mean, I remember it so vividly, and I think that would be a really cool premise for a film.
I was going to say, that is incredible. That I'm seeing movie already forming in my mind right there.
Yeah, I've been doing meditation my whole life. So one of the meditation people that I work with right now, like, I told her about this probably 13 years ago. And she's the one that said that it's very, very unique that, you know, people remember that kind of stuff. I just thought it was normal.
Yeah.
But Yeah, I realize I'm weird.
Well, I guess what's normal, right? You know, from you, it is normal. That's perspective. And you know, you are somebody that obviously, and again, talking to you, knowing you, you are at a very high frequency. You have a very good understanding. You have a good feel of the universe. You can, you know, you sense things before they almost happen. You seem to have that kind of aura about, you know, for better or worse, right? Now, when you're about to do your first film, right, A Gun for Jennifer, you wrote that film, correct, for yourself? Yeah, that's great. And that kind of was your first feature film that you did.
Yeah, and I was a baby. I mean,
sure.
That was crazy. And initially, we were going to do it for, we thought we'd do it for like $100,000. The guy that I was with at the time, he actually did the final pass on the script.
Sure.
Because he added like this whole cop element, which was great. That's how we got Arthur Nescarella.
Yeah.
You know, people like that. And Todd did a good job. The director, Todd Morris. But that was such an interesting experience because literally before that, I had gone to NYU to study drama. But I left after a year and a half because my parents used the money for college to start a company. And then they told me, you know, okay, you got to come home. And I'm like, no, I'll stay. And so I just started acting privately. But my plan was to get emancipated and then be able to take out loans and go to NYU film school. Because when I told my dad that I was going to go to NYU and study acting, he was really upset. He said, you know, you're just going to end up being like a waitress or something. And I said, oh, no, daddy, I'll end up making my own movies. I was 15 when that conversation happened. But so I was able to really learn just by doing. You know, I mean, I was super young, but I was determined and I just kept reading all the books that I could and, you know, looking at all the filmmaker magazines that were available then and all this other stuff. And it really was trial by fire. And, you know, we did it. Luckily, Todd came from a very strong production background. We had met at a commercial production company. I worked there as a receptionist so I could learn about production. And that was a really good experience in some ways.
Yeah, and again, I've you know, had similar jobs like that where I interned or worked at kind of front desk for different production companies. Yeah. When you suggest people, again, for young listeners that are trying to break into the business, you're not going to start as a director or a producer or a writer. It's good to get your foot in the door and be willing to kind of, you know, take your ego to the back seat and take those jobs to learn.
Absolutely. And that's why even like being a production assistant,
sure,
you know, you're getting paid to learn everything. And, you know, if you could just like, you know, yes, keep your ego in check and learn, you know, that's better than any film school. It really is. Because, and so many people that have gone to film school, NYU or Columbia or UCLA or whatever, they've all said the same thing that, you know, they may learn the technical things in order to like be, you know, directing or shooting or whatever, but they don't know anything about the film business from going to film school. No. Nothing. They don't teach that. You can't teach it.
Every business. Not the knowledge, which is power. It's the applied knowledge, which is power. So you have to be in there and, you know, working.
Yep, absolutely. Yep. It's critical.
No, you're absolutely right. And what you're saying, especially with the they don't teach it. I don't think a lot of professors there are in the field at the time that you're learning. The business is evolving, right? So
yeah.
A professor that was in the field 15 years ago, the knowledge they know about the business does not apply to today. So especially in our world now with the always changing AdVod and the way distribution changes and the way films are now shot and acquired, if you're learning business skills from 10 years ago, they are not going to apply to a filmmaker today at all.
No, totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they've got professors that have been at NYU since, the 80s, 90s?
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Like, you know, they're probably still talking about shooting in 16 millimeters.
Well, yeah, we'll sell it on beta. We'll be good. Yeah. Yes. So we're good to go. And that works, yeah. Right? So, yeah.
I mean, are there even any developing labs left? Like, Duart's gone.
Yeah.
Kodak. What was the other company? There was a company that was on Broadway.
Fuji was around for a while.
And, right, yeah.
Yeah.
And they were all, like, but, like, they're all gone. Like,
no,
how do people even get film developed?
They tried making it come back, but you know, the way films are sold now, and look, it is a beautiful medium. We see people like Tarantino use it, and people of that caliber, yes. I mean, who wouldn't want to shoot on film? But for like, filmmaker. Exactly, right? If you're doing your first film, that's your a goal. That might be the wrong way to go. But again, look, I always say this. If you stick to your convictions and you're a young filmmaker that says, I just want to shoot on film, you may be the most talented filmmaker. So if that's what you want to do, do it, right? I always say, like, never hold somebody back in their dreams. If that's what your vision is, go for your vision. And you're right. So
Just hope you got the money.
Yes, no, at the end of the day. I mean, talking about vision, right? So you finish your first feature film, and now you're an actress. You're getting known in the world, and you start getting out there. You start booking some roles. You've been on some pretty big TV shows. You start getting guest spots. You start doing that. How did that kind of feel as an actress now to kind of, it must give validation to your craft, right? Like,
oh, so much. Well, and this is the thing. So my path as a woman in New York and in the film world, like, is pretty much marked by relationships. And so I was with the first guy and we made a movie together. Then we made another movie. Like, it was our baby that was going to try to like save the marriage, even though we weren't married, but you know, the relationship was failing. So, you know, in order to like fix things, he was like, come on, let's make another movie. And I was like, no, I just want to go. And he's like, let's make another movie. Like, literally, it's like hear people do, you know, they have a baby.
Yeah, it's like being a baby. Yeah.
Anyway, when we went to get the permitting for that, and I wanted so badly, I've been asking him for 3 years to let me go. I was like, please, I was having to like work to support him. He was sitting at home writing The Great American Screenplay, all he gets on TV every night. Yeah. And I wanted out. I wanted out so badly. So, you know, he insisted we make this other movie. Funny thing was, I had to go and put my insurance with the mayor's office of film.
Sure.
And I thought it was going to be the same guy that I dealt with A Gun for Jennifer, which was Richard Brick, who was a dick. Brick the dick. He was so mean.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, he didn't like indie film. I mean, and
sure.
Just horrible ego. So, I had to give them the insurance and then file for the first permit. And on the permit, like, first of all, it was going to be in a hot spot. It was in West Village.
Sure.
And I needed to shoot somebody and stick them in a trunk. So it was like, okay, hot spot and doing that.
Yeah.
No, you have to stop. You have to wait and talk to the director of production. And I was just like, oh, no, not Richard Brick.
Yeah.
Please, no. And so I'm just sitting there and I'm waiting and I'm just, you know, thinking, please, why is this happening to me? You know, I don't even want to make this movie. And then this guy sticks his head out of the office and I feel electricity literally go from my toes all the way up through my body. And it's this guy, Dean McCann. And he's like, hi, are you Deborah Twist? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, hi, I'm the Dean McCann, director of production. I understand you have a problem with your permit. Do you want to come in? I was like, and like we sat there talking for about 20 minutes and the whole time I was sitting there, we're talking about indie film and everything else. And I've got in my mind, I'm like, Todd's downstairs in the car. I got to get out of that relationship. Like, this week, this is over. I have to, like, I'm done. Because this guy. And literally, that was in September of 99. And we got married in January of 2002.
There you go. You knew it. You felt it.
And with the relationship I'd had with Todd, I was not allowed to audition.
No.
I wasn't allowed to do anything. It was all about like, oh, baking the movies together and, you know, who do you think you are? Like,
yeah.
No, you have to support me and I'm a director and all this other stuff. So it was like, that was another thing that like really ended it because I'm
sure,
you know, I was not the kind of person that liked to be stopped. So the beauty of Dean especially was that he was so supportive and, you know, he'd seen A Gun for Jennifer and, you know, we first became really good friends and then it got a bit romantic.
Sure.
But he was just so much about how, you know, he wanted me to come into my power and find my way and, you know, be able to like act in all these different things. And he was just such a champion. Even like he passed away April 30th. And he was like my biggest champion. He was like the guy that, you know, encouraged me even like the first movie that I made on my own completely was in 2005. And I had both my kids at that time. And when I shot it, it's called In Between. It was based on, it's a supernatural drama about 9/11. And Dean and I had gone through that whole tragedy together. We lived at Canal and Greenwich when it happened. So that was the thing that really like bonded us so deeply. We got engaged literally 1 month after we went through that. And then a month after that, I found out I was pregnant with my son. And it was like, okay, well, we shouldn't get married in the spring because I'll be really big. So let's just, so we moved it up to January. And it was just a really great beginning. And ultimately, though, from what I had found out, he had had a bad drinking problem prior to working with the mayor's office. And one of the things that he had taken that job for was that he would be forced to have a normal 9-to-5 and have to be responsible. And I even in his journals, which I've read now, he said that, you know, he knew that he would find his wife working there. And he did. And throughout our whole marriage, you know, I kept trying to save his life. My kids kept trying to save his life. And he was never somebody who was abusive or mean or, you know, he wouldn't yell at us. We ended up rescuing all these dogs and cats together. I mean, he loved rescuing little animals with me. He encouraged me and my kids to just be the best that we could be. And my son is actually determined to go to Columbia Law School. He's going to Marist, but he wants to go to Columbia Law because Dean had a law degree. And, you know, we would have all these conversations about law and, you know, what was right. Because in the indie film world, I've gone up against plenty of lawsuits. Many people coming at me with claims and everything. And that was another thing. Like, Dean taught me really how to read a lawsuit properly.
Sure.
Yeah. And go through and make notes and all this other stuff. And he was just literally the week before he passed away, he said to me, he was like, and I think he knew that he was about to go. He said, you know, I just want to tell you how much I love you. And I know that, you know, you're about to come into like the best time of your life. And you are just so amazing. I am so proud of everything you've done. You raised great kids. You rescued amazing animals. Yeah. And, you know, everything from here, it's just going to be like the sky's the limit. Yeah. And I was just like, oh, thank you. And I'm just, I'm so glad that, you know, I had that.
Yeah.
It was really special. So
had the like the artist's curse where they're so sensitive, maybe that they hurt no one but themselves.
Well, yes, I found out in the last 3 years just exactly what had happened to him, and he had been abused badly by a counselor at a private school in Brooklyn from the time he was 8 till he was 16. Yep, and we're actually still dealing with that.
Sure.
If we could help get that lawsuit done and everything. But, you know, he was a very, very good, sweet, sensitive man. And people throughout the film world just loved him. He ended up, you know, he rose all the way to deputy commissioner of the film office.
Yeah, sure.
And because of him, you know, I met basically everybody that does anything over with.
Sure.
You know, like, I'm friends with the guy that runs Times Square, and you know, I can shoot there. I mean, I know how to deal with just about any kind of permit. You know, we would have these long conversations. He'd tell me about how, you know, well, this shoot, they want to go and they want to blow up this thing over here, and I want to tell them no. And I'd be like, oh, who's the director? And he'd tell me, I'd be like, we got to make it happen. And he's like, really? Okay, well, I'm going to tell my wife said
it. That's it. There you go. Look at that. Hey, that's good.
No, you know, but we were really just best friends,
sure.
Nothing else. And, you know, the typical like marriage scenario pretty much ended by 2008. But, you know, we lived as like co-parents and best friends, and, you know, we supported each other in so many other ways. And it was really a very unique relationship.
Sure.
And I feel in some ways, like what it did, this, because it was pretty much like a celibate relationship in 2008, because he was so focused on trying to harm himself. So I dove very deeply into meditation and creating content and writing scripts and really like going to like that darkest place inside, that where I was hurting and where I was watching him hurt, and try to find these things that could hopefully, you know, make into films and make into scripts that people would watch, and they would be able to heal in their own way from the things that I was experiencing.
Sure.
And looking at everything, the body of work that I did while we were together, it was in between Harry Carey, the only short film I ever. it was so fun. And Dean's in it.
Hey, that's right.
He's in it. It's so funny. And then Sebastian.
Yes, yep, it, yep.
Which is two different films because of the director's cut. Confidence Game, Beautiful Distraction, Crazy Town, Super Sexual. I feel like there's something else too. But yeah, I mean, eight.
That's huge. That's somebody.
I think that's. Okay. It's nothing. Like, there's so many scammer calls. It's just like it was constant.
You know, what's interesting when you said about healing and the process of healing and spirituality in your films, you know, I was very fortunate to be your premiere of A Cry From Within. I thought it was a great movie, right? Yeah, at the SBA theater. That was great. And that whole film has to do with healing and the character of Sebastian and Kathy Moriarty's character and everybody kind of coming full circle. That has to do a lot with what you just said there. I never knew that personal side of you then, you know, about that. And there's so much in that movie. I really just people go out and watch it because it's an incredible film. I thought it was great. You know, yourself, Eric Roberts, Kathy Moriarty, you guys all do a great job in the movie, but it has to do with everything you just said. Really powerful.
Well, and you should watch Sebastian then, because sure. I went in and I put back in 20 minutes of footage from Belfry. That was really critical to the character because I like one of the reasons the whole Tom Belfry storyline was taken out and it was called A Cry From Within was because my producer's rep at the time said that my character, if she was involved in this potential affair, it would make her unsympathetic. And I said, but this is more realistic.
Sure.
You know, these like because there's this moment with Eric Roberts where he is having a fantasy about one of his clients.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, I wanted to show that, you know, these are damaged people that are broken and their marriage is broken. And it's through, you know, this experience that they have with Sebastian that they come back together. So, you know, that was really important. So the Sebastian is the way it was originally intended. The
story. Yeah, yeah.
And I changed a lot of the music. I wanted, there's more music that I wanted. I also wanted like better flashbacks. Sure. There's one moment at the sink in the end. And there were just, there's all these extra things that are in it. So it's a far better film. Far better. I love it. Yeah.
I can see all those story arcs making it such a better film. Not that it was, because again, you're right, because it seems like a more personal journey for you with that part of the story that needed to be there. You could see how a producer's rep, if they're just looking at surface level, that's what they're looking at, right? Okay, surface level, common denominator, easiest way, take that out.
Right.
So I guess you can justify why they would, but I see the real potential of what Sebastian could be. And you can probably see that now, what, Tubi, is that available on?
Oh, yeah. It's doing quite well on Tubi, but, and I'm happy that it's there. Because I want films that are able to be seen by a lot of people. And Tubi is so excellent. You know, the fact that you don't have to pay any kind of subscription or anything.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I mean, I just want you to know that film inspired me so much because that's right around the time I was doing Around Every Corner. And when I saw you do that, I said, wow, I mean, that was incredible. Really, I said, like, I want to make something like that. Really, it meant so much for me that I was invited to go, you know, watch that film's premiere. And again, it was really inspiring. It was. So really, you inspired me a lot by watching that.
And I love your film. And you are a great actor. Like, I've wanted to work with you. Even Sapir Sexual, I wanted you originally as the guy.
Yeah.
And I just thought, the timing just didn't.
No, it didn't work. Yeah.
But I was so frustrated because I want to work with you. I want to act with you.
Thank you.
And we'll get there.
No, well, exactly. That's the thing. When you appreciate somebody's craft and you respect somebody, you'll get there and you'll work at the right time. Everybody like wants to rush everything. And if someone's busier, we both have two things going on, it's better to wait. Do it at the right time when everybody can really be committed to what they're doing.
Totally. Yeah. And then there's this thing that I believe, and I do this all the time with myself, because I get so frustrated sometimes when it looks like something's about to happen and then it doesn't.
Sure.
They're like, and then wait, let go. You know, there's a reason, like the universe did not need you to do that right now. You're being led down a different path. You got to learn something or something's going to happen. I was supposed to make my new film Broken at the end of May. And I guess it was about mid-April, the guy that was financing it got in touch with me and said, look, Deb, I'm really sorry, but you know, things have turned a little bit and I'm not going to be able to finance the film then. And I already had, you know, Michael Paré ready to go and like all these people. And I had this moment of like, oh my God, but what I'm like, oh, I'm going to look so bad. And then I thought, wait a second. This is very strange. So what if I just let go and trust the universe and allow that, like, whatever reason I'm being stopped from doing this right now is for the higher good. And then literally within 14 days, my husband passed away, and there was no way in a million years I could have made that film in May. Not in, like, and if the financing had been there and we had already paid for Michael Pare and everything, I would have had to, like, figure something out, because there's no way I'd have been able to, you know, it's a very deep, deep, dark, violent film. Like, there, I'd be just like, I would have been a mess.
Yeah, you're mentally not there. How can you do it?
Where now, like, now I'm ready. It's like, okay, it's go time.
Yeah.
It took all summer to just journal and look at pictures and look at all my old journals from the very beginning of when we were married.
Sure.
To, like, really document to myself, remember, because, you know, when people pass away, there's that initial thing of, like, oh, they were a saint and everything was beautiful. It's like, wait a second. No, the trouble really started when I was even pregnant with Maddie, where, like, she started drinking a lot. And, like, it's all there. Like, I kept journals that showed me. And, I mean, the journals are still next to my bed. And anytime I start getting into this, like, oh, it's so, I'm like, whoa, wait a second. Let's get a hard, you know, recheck on reality. See exactly what went down. And I, you know, look at it, and then I'm like, okay, well then, you know, like, write down your limiting beliefs that came because of that. Now, like, flip it. What is a new belief you want to install? And, like, literally, like, every single day, working deep, 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 deep inner work. You know, it happened April 30th. I think I'm on day 109 right now.
Sure.
And I feel like it's actually been 10 years. I've done that level of inner work. And there's this really cool woman from Australia, Margarita Billeroff, and she does emotional freedom technique, EFT.
Sure.
So, like, I've been enrolled in her stuff throughout the summer. I did a Lionsgate portal thing with her and these two other guys. This other dude who's in the UK, Craig Kahn, he does a thing. You guys would love this. It's a quantum jumping meditation. It's a 90-minute thing, and before you do it, you journal about, like, a desired timeline, an alternate timeline that you'd like to explore of yourself, and you go into this very deep meditation, and you meet this other actualized version of yourself that's living this other life where these things all happen, and you have a conversation with that self, and that self will tell you, guide you about, you know, what they did, how, you know, their perspective on things that changed things just enough so that, like, you can achieve this thing that you're trying to do. Life changing.
I'm sure I was going to say, it sounds life changing.
And I started
that
literally 2 weeks after Dean passed away on May 14th. And I was doing, like, 3 a week for a while. And now it's down to just Sundays. But I highly encourage you guys. And it's only, like £10, which is, I think, $13.
Something like that, yeah.
Cheap. And it's so worth it. Like, I'm gonna be at the one and Zoom. I'm going to do the one that's this coming Sunday. But I mean, you know, all these different things from the time, you know, things got really crazy with Dean in 2008, all this deep, deep, deep self-work, inner work, you know, Abraham Hicks, all kinds of meditation. It has Michelle Colt. I don't know if you guys know Michelle Colt. She's amazing. Like, they call her the nervous system whisperer because she literally, like, can has all these different amazing that she has a great podcast too. That you
check it out.
But it's all about, like, how you can find this inner alignment and, you know, get in touch with, like, your inner self, your child self, and, you know, do the things that will soothe your inner child and create, like, a very clear path to the things that you want. So, I mean, I feel like I should, I could do, like, you know, a whole thing about this. This, like, bag of tricks.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I give people, like, assignments. Like, you need a little bit of this guy, a little bit of that guy.
All ears. I mean, I'm not a child that needs some work.
Oh. Well, I got the people for you. Yeah, do I have the people for you? But it's been a profoundly transformative experience being with Dean, knowing Dean, going through this, raising children within this environment, teaching them that, you know, just because somebody it has fallen does not mean you abandon them.
Sure, absolutely.
One of the things, you know, I was telling you guys before we started, you know, I lost a lot of friends that would say, you know, well, you know, if you're going to just support this, you're just being a codependent and, you know, you need to like leave him. And if, you know, if he fails, then he's going to hit his bottom. And I was like, you know, his bottom is death.
Yeah.
And if I leave and I take the kids and the animals, he will not make it a month. I know that.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, if that's what's supposed to happen, that's what's supposed to happen. I'm like, you tell that to my children.
Sure. Yeah.
And people are like, well, you know, it's better for your children if you go. I'm like, you know.
No, it's always interesting when people try to interject their personal thoughts into your life.
Yep.
You know, they don't know what your burdens are. They don't know what your children's going through.
Yep.
Why would you interject and try to give somebody an opinion about something that doesn't even matter to you in the first place? Because they don't care at the end of the day. They'll give you that opinion, and then your kids are going to suffer, and they'll be gone. They're not going to care what happens.
Right.
2 weeks later, right? They have no, it doesn't matter to them.
I bet you haven't asked once for an opinion, but they feel free to give it to you. That's my experience.
Well, yeah, and many times. There was one in particular. She actually ran this meditation circle, and I was not that present for these meetings. It was like a bunch of chicks and really annoying. They whine about how, like, her husband bought the wrong granola. Meanwhile, I'm dealing with, like, you know, somebody that might die from alcohol. And she took me aside on a call one day, and she's like, you know, I really can't be supportive of having you in our circle anymore, because, you know, if you can't just break away from this and find your inner power. And I was like, but that is not going to be power. You know, if I leave a man down, I said, you know what, he's abusing himself. He's not hurting me. He's not hurting the kids. He clearly has issues. And it was, you know, I'm here to try to help him. He doesn't drink at work. He doesn't drink and drive. He doesn't do any of that. He comes home. He, like, goes in the hole.
Yeah.
You know, and clearly he's trying to, like, escape something. And, you know, yeah, I didn't figure out what it was until the pandemic, really, is when he really revealed to us. Because he thought he was going to die at that point. They diagnosed him with cancer and COPD and all this other stuff. And he would say, you know, you got to just let me go. We got to, and I kept trying and kept trying and kept trying. But yeah, I mean, I think as artists, you know, what makes us is the shit.
Yeah.
You know, what we go through, that's what we draw upon. I've never met anybody that is good at doing what they do in our world that has had a perfect life. I've never met a single person who came from, you know, what was the perfect family, right? There's always something. Like, we all have, like, this deep inner pain that connects us with this bigger picture of the world and makes us just, you know, love and cherish humanity so much and want so badly to connect heart to heart with an audience and with each other.
Sure.
I mean, look what happens when we're on set and we're in a deep, intense scene.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you're crying and connecting. I mean, there is no more beautiful moment of art than that, you know? And that, the beauty of digital cinema too, like, digital picks up that energy.
It does. Yeah.
It picks that up. And then the audience feels that. And that's why people, you know, that's why things have gotten so much more intense, I believe. And I think it's because of the whole digital revolution. Also because we don't need as much time in between setups.
100%.
So, you know, as actors, we're able to hold that level of intensity and focus and just, like, go so deep. Yeah, I mean,
Don't worry about the way you look.
No.
Just, I mean, we never do, but I'm not.
Yeah. Marks and, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's at that moment too where, you know, and you don't even care. Like, you know, with powder, it's like, no, it's sweaty right now.
No, let it be there. Yeah.
Like, why would you powder that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're in the moment there.
Yeah.
And I think that's what so many, you know, listeners here that are trying to break into the business, follow their dreams, become actors, actresses, directors, producers, they have to realize that. And what you said was so important, to appreciate those moments, to be a true artist, to embrace what's there, to embrace the issues, to actually put that out on the screen, not trying to make everything perfect and manufactured. And that's a great lesson that everybody really needs to hear. Because I think everybody's trying to just impress people and be seen now, especially in the social media generation. Everybody wants to show me, and are kind of taking back away from the artists a little bit sometimes. I mean, it feels that way.
I mean, the shit is our manner.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we create things from. You know, even some of the darkest moments in my life, the thing that's helped me get through them is thinking, you know, just hold on to this, hold on to everything you're thinking and feeling right now, because, you know, this is something that you can use to help people.
Sure.
You can turn this into a script or use this in a movie or use this, you know, on a TV show. And this is the depth of what that means when a person gets this thing to happen inside of them. And you know, if we had really great lives where everything was excellent, we would never be able to comprehend.
Yeah, audience can identify with that. It's not real.
Yeah, exactly.